the Rich case versus Commonwealth, Mr. Martingale, Mr. Sandoval. Good morning.
Good morning. May I proceed?
You may. Would you like to reserve some rebuttal time?
I would, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes, please.
Certainly. Thank you.
Thank you. And before I get started, I would like to thank the court and opposing counsel for agreeing to the schedule change that allowed me to attend 2 meetings yesterday in Richmond. So thank you for that professional courtesy.
You're very welcome.
May it please the court, my name is Kevin Martingale. I represent the appellant in this matter, Rihanna Rich. This is a case that involves two assignments of error. Number one, we take the position that the Commonwealth failed to prove the causation element at trial. Number two, we contend that the issue of criminal negligence was not proved at trial. Very briefly, the facts of this matter are the following. This involves an unfortunate automobile collision. It involves a car and a motorized wheelchair device. This occurred in Virginia Beach Boulevard, which is also 17th Street, near the oceanfront area in Virginia Beach at approximately 2:30 in the morning in an area that was extremely poorly lit. The operator of the wheelchair device was in an unlit, unmarked, no reflectors wheelchair. We don't know exactly how fast he was going at the time of the collision. We don't know what path he took for a period of time that is very crucial to the determination in this case. He was seen in the roadway by another driver, Deja Young. She saw him and was concerned about the way he was operating this wheelchair device. He was swerving, meandering, appeared to be eating something. She put her window down. She was only driving 15 miles an hour in a 35-mile-per-hour zone. She expressed concern about his safety and said, "You need to be careful. You know, what are you doing?" And he was utterly unresponsive, appeared to be highly intoxicated. It turns out he was. He had a .22 BAC, we learned later on. She continued on her way. Some period of time later, believed to be approximately 30 seconds, she hears a collision occur behind her. She looks in her rearview mirror, sees things scattering, goes up to a gas station, comes back, takes a look. She saw the aftermath of an accident that occurred between Ms. Rich and the man in the wheelchair. Now, the evidence that was used to explain why she was the cause of this accident came down to the following, that she failed to keep a lookout, supposedly, because she leaned over for 1 second, according to the record, to attempt to get a cigarette lit. Supposedly, she was sleep-deprived, and I will argue to you that that's not proved by this record. She supposedly failed the brake, which was not proved by the record. She was intoxicated, which we do not argue at this point. Now, this is the problem with the causation aspect of this case. The Commonwealth failed to prove 50% of what it needed to prove. And it didn't prove the other half either. But we know on the 50% involving the wheelchair device, they were unable to prove what happened with him. Where did he go? How fast did he go? What path did he take? Any of that. And there is case after case from the 60s coming forward till now saying that it is the burden of a party trying to prove that someone else is responsible for a collision to show what happened. And that means proving two halves. It means proving what the driver of the car did, and in this case, what did the operator of the wheelchair do. When he was seen by Ms. Young, the testimony was that he was facing a southeast direction. When he was, according to the police officer testimony, he appeared to be going southbound. We don't know exactly what path he took in between. We don't know how fast. We don't know the capabilities of the wheelchair device.
You know the point of impact, though, don't you?
We do.
Because we see the pictures and we see where what was left in the road from the point of impact. Given that and the fact that Ms. Young's testimony about, she certainly said everything you just said, but she also indicated she thought she would have avoided him. And given what we know about, you know, your client's blood alcohol content, which was taken several hours later, I guess 2 hours later, wasn't it? It's considerably above the legal limit. I thought, and correct me if I'm wrong, please, but I thought, Mr. Martingale, she had conceded that she'd only had about 2 hours of sleep the night before. And she's driving. It's like, as you say, nearly 2:30 again in the morning the next night. And she's leaning over to get her cigarette lit, even if it's very briefly, by her boyfriend, who's apparently more intoxicated than she is. Why, at that point, don't we see causation as well as criminal negligence?
I'll try to take those several items one at a time. First of all, focusing on Ms. Young. Ms. Young did not speculate that she would have been able to avoid him. She said she would have been able to see him. And that is specifically at page 25. She also said at pages 26 and 27 that if anybody else had been driving fast, they wouldn't have been able to avoid him. She was driving 15 miles an hour, according to her testimony, and was being unusually cautious because she was driving a car she wasn't familiar with. And so she was concerned about that. So the law doesn't require a hypervigilance standard. It requires ordinary care. So comparing her to Ms. Young, Rich to Ms. Young, is really an unfair comparison. But Ms. Young did not speculate that if she'd been doing the speed limit, she would have been able to avoid him. I think actually the fair inference from her testimony is the opposite, that she was concerned that anybody doing the speed limit would have hit this man. That's why she stopped, put the window down, and warned him. And what she was concerned about is exactly what happened next. On the issue of the sleep, there is no testimony that she looked tired by anybody who dealt with her. There is no testimony that she appeared to be falling asleep, that she was incoherent in her interactions with the police officers. In fact, to the opposite, the officer testified that in his interactions with her, she was responsive, she was able to answer questions and so forth. She didn't do particularly well on coordination tests, but she did not do anything that indicated that the 2 hours of sleep she referenced many hours after the fact means we can draw a reasonable inference that at the time of the driving that played any role in it. I am sure that with a rush of adrenaline associated with an accident, she felt quite tired hours later. That combined maybe with only having a couple hours of sleep. But what we don't know and cannot reasonably infer from this record is that while driving, that she was fatigued in any manner. That's just too much of a stretch.
A rational fact finder can't conclude that if you've already had a lot of alcohol, so that your blood alcohol content is well above the legal limit, and you concede you only slept 2 hours the night before, and it's now 2:30 in the morning of the next night, that your rational fact finder couldn't conclude that you're probably tired and aren't reacting as quickly as you would otherwise.
I would submit to you that not only did the judge not identify the facts upon which he was relying for the fatigue, but the only evidence in the record is a single statement made hours after the fact, when now she's been up for a really long period of time, gone through the trauma of the collision itself, plus the dealing with the police. Now she's down at the police station. A lot of time has passed, and she makes this one stray statement. What's missing from the record is this. You don't have a single admission or observation or any physical indication that she was tired while driving. And I would submit to you, it's a fine line. But in this case, it is a leap to go all the way to she was excessively fatigued while she was operating the car. I think, if anything, the record indicates that she was now acknowledging that she was tired hours later, which is, of course, natural. But I do believe that's a stretch there. It really, what you come down to in this record is it's intoxication plus either zero or plus very little. That's really what this record is all about. Because when you take them one at a time, first of all, the Commonwealth argued repeatedly that it was everything taken together. Now, the judge disagreed. He made a comment to the effect that the act of reaching for a cigarette in and of itself constituted sufficient negligence for criminal negligence. And I would submit to you that is just wrong. If that's the basis of his ruling, there is no law that supports that. If 1 second light a cigarette equals criminal negligence, then looking in a mirror to change lanes on the interstate would indicate some form of negligence. Or changing your radio station, or looking at your phone because it's ringing, and even if you don't answer it, looking away for 1 second is not evidence of negligence.
Mr. Martin, wasn't it more than just this? I mean, it was leaning over to get it lit from a boyfriend who apparently is pretty far down in the seat himself.
And absolutely, she indicated she turned her head, she leaned for 1 second, looked up in time to hit her brakes, and then she couldn't avoid hitting him. The issue is, first of all, if she leaned, you would think maybe she swerved. There's no evidence that she swerved. She was operating the car otherwise in a manner that was not only lawful, but actually below the speed limit according to the evidence. So the sleep deprivation, I don't believe it adds anything to Connell's case. The failure to keep a proper lookout consisting of a one-second look away. I can't find an example of a one-second look away ever being sufficient under any cases. The failure to brake is interesting because of this. First of all, they rely on an absence, not a presence of any evidence, but an absence of brake skid marks or something like that. Well, where's the evidence of the qualities of this car? Do we know whether or not it had anti-lock brakes? I know the answer, but I'm not going to argue outside the record. But there's nothing in the record that tells you anything about the braking qualities of this car, whether we would have expected to hear any hard braking or anything like that. The Commonwealth tried to make that argument, then abandoned it in the trial court, and instead argued there were three factors that indicated guilt: intoxication, sleep deprivation, the cigarette. Now on appeal, they've revived that argument, trying to breathe new life back into it, because I guess the judge mentioned it in his decision announcing why he was getting to the result he was reaching. But the absence of evidence without the rest of what you need doesn't prove anything. I mean, it's pure speculation on this record that there was a failure to brake. And in fact, it contradicts the only thing we know. We know that she gave a statement to the police saying, "I slammed on the brakes." And there's no reason to believe, based on this record, that there would have been a skid mark. Most modern cars, I think the court can take judicial notice, don't skid. That's why we have anti-lock brakes. So I believe that adds literally nothing to the case. In the end, there is a lot of case law out there saying that it is the burden of, whether you're talking about a plaintiff in a civil case or the Commonwealth in a criminal case, to prove both halves of what happened. What was the driver doing who was accused of driving improperly? And what was the other person, whether a pedestrian, a person lying in the roadway, a wheelchair operator, a bicyclist, a car, a truck? Both sides, it is the burden on the party accusing someone of causing an accident to show what everybody was doing at the time of the collision. And there is a huge gap in this record as to Mr. Costello. The police did the best they could. The Commonwealth did the best they could. But the fact is, we don't know. We don't know how long. We don't know the path he took. No one knows how fast one of these motorized devices go. Does it go 20 miles an hour, or does it just go 2 miles an hour? Can they turn on a dime? Can they go around in circles? We don't know any of these things. They're not in the record. And that means that this is a speculative conviction. It cannot stand. And I would like to reserve the rest of my time, if I may. Thank you very much.
Good morning. May it please the court, Christian Annabelle for the Commonwealth. This case is a fact-intensive case, and yet the law in this case is fairly straightforward. The Commonwealth was required to prove that Ms. Rich acted criminally negligent and that her intoxication and negligence caused the injuries to the victim, Mr. Costello. On the causation side of things, the case law in this state has repeatedly held that in similar contexts, in voluntary manslaughter cases, the contributory negligence of the victim plays no role in that analysis unless it can be shown that the victim caused 100% of the accident, so it was 100% responsible. Or another way of saying it is that the victim's contributory negligence alone caused the accident. Otherwise, if the defendant's behavior, intoxication, was a cause and a but-for cause of the accident, it doesn't matter in the law of DUI maiming or DUI involuntary manslaughter whether the victim contributed through his own negligence to the accident occurring.
Can I follow up with you on that?
Yes, Your Honor.
If in this situation she was completely sober, she was going under the speed limit, and this accident then occurred, would there be, what would be the result there? Now, admittedly, you don't have the DUI aspect of it.
Now, right. Well, I think that case would be closer to the line. I can't say for sure that even there you could hold as a matter of law that I mean, you'd have to show some negligence. There has to be some evidence of criminal negligence. In the scenario you've painted, it sounds like there's no evidence as to whether she was acting negligent, whether she looked away, whether she was intoxicated.
But your argument is that even if she's going under the speed limit and she's driving under the influence, and it's 0.8 or more, or otherwise shown to be under the influence, that's enough right there, even if his wheelchair pulled in front of him.
If her negligence contributed to that accident, and it cannot be said that his negligence was the sole cause of the accident, then correct. For the causation element, that's enough. You still have to look at the criminal negligence prong. But on the causation side of things, unless he's 100% responsible, that you cannot blame the victim in a case like this. You might be able to do so in a civil case, but you cannot do so in the criminal context. I'll give you an example of a case where perhaps you could hold that causation had not been proven based on the victim's negligence. So if, for example, the victim, there was evidence or it was left open to speculation whether perhaps the victim might have jumped out into the middle of the street from the bushes into the path of an oncoming car, or rolled into the street and was lying in the street at the last possible moment, or maybe ran into the street in front of an oncoming car. There you might conclude that his negligence, even if she had been intoxicated, even if she had not been paying attention, if someone runs in front of you at the last second, you could hold that that individual is entirely responsible. In the cases that opposing counsel cited on brief, specifically, the cases Hoffner, McManama, and Farron, in each of those cases you had scenarios like that where the evidence either showed or was unclear as to whether the victim had possibly run. In one case, the victim ran behind a truck that was backing up, and the plaintiff hit that victim. Another case, the victim might have rolled into the middle of the street, and the plaintiff hit the victim. Another case, I think it was unclear whether the court said it's unclear. The victim may have at the last possible moment run into an intersection, and that victim was struck and killed. And so under those circumstances, yes, the defendant is entitled to a summary judgment because there's no way of telling whether perhaps the victim might have been entirely responsible, and thus causation cannot be proven. In this case, we didn't have that. In this case, we have an individual who is incapable of running or jumping into the middle of the street because he was confined to a motorized wheelchair. And although we don't have a witness who stood on the side of the road and watched the entire events unfold, we do have enough testimony through the witness of Ms. Young and even through Ms. Rich's own statements to paint a clear picture of exactly what happened, that this victim was crossing the street in his wheelchair, going from one side of the street to the other. When Ms. Young left him, he had made it to the middle of the street. And when he was struck by Ms. Rich, he had made it all the way to the lane closest to the sidewalk, which he was headed towards. And when he was hit, and the pictures show, he was still facing that sidewalk. So whether he was swerving to some extent or not, the evidence painted a clear picture that as she was approaching him, he would have been in the middle of the street and making his way across those remaining two lanes of oncoming traffic and had just gotten into Ms. Rich's lane when she struck him. So in circumstances like that, it is clearly not plainly wrong for the trial court to conclude that she should have been able to see him, she should have been able to stop in time, and that her negligence, her high level of intoxication, her extreme sleep deprivation, and her looking away while she's driving constitutes criminal negligence and was a proximate cause, a but-for cause of that accident occurring. Now, on appeal, Rich has essentially argued that the trial court erred as a matter of law by not believing her self-serving statements to the officer. So, on appeal, Rich is not contesting the fact that she was driving with a blood alcohol content level of at least a 0.13. And I've submitted on brief that in a light most favorable to the Commonwealth, it could have been as high as a 0.16. Rich has not contested on appeal that she was sleep deprived. She'd been up for 18 straight hours, and before that, she had only slept for 2 hours. Courts are entitled to use their common sense, and anyone can apply common sense and conclude that if you've been up for 18 straight hours, only slept 2 hours the night before, there are going to be some effects on your reaction time and your ability to react to emergencies while driving, which is what occurred here. Rich also does not contest that she did take her eyes off the road and look away. Now, what she argues is that she was able to look up in time in order to see the victim in the road and in order to slam on her brakes, and she argues that she only looked away for 1 second in order to allow her extremely intoxicated boyfriend to light that cigarette. And I would submit that the trial court is not required to believe that self-serving statement. In fact, the law goes the opposite, that the fact finder is entitled to find that she was lying to conceal her guilt, and those lies can be taken as evidence of her guilt. Admittedly, this is another area where the trial court is entitled to use common sense. I'm not a smoker. I don't know if the trial court was a smoker. But I think it's common sense that someone who is intoxicated and is driving and is leaning over to let someone else who is extremely intoxicated to light a cigarette, that cannot be done in 1 second. And there's also testimony from an expert about the effects of alcohol and how it slows everything down. It slows down your reaction times. It slows down how long it would take you to take your eyes off the road to lean to the side. So the court was entitled to find that those statements were dishonest. And while the court is not entitled to arbitrarily reject testimony, there were reasons to believe that those statements were dishonest. She gave multiple accounts to the officer as to how much alcohol she had had to drink that night, as to when she had had that alcohol, whether it was before 6 o'clock p.m., whether it was after 6 o'clock, whether it was between 6 and 6:45, whether she had had just wine at home or whether she had had some drinks at the ball game. And she claimed that she went to a couple of bars with her boyfriend but only drank water at those bars. Between all of these different statements, the court was entitled to find that she was making statements that she felt like were in her best interest, and that includes her claim that she only looked away for 1 second and that she looked up in time in order to attempt to stop. Additionally, the physical evidence and the evidence of the ear witnesses contradicted her testimony. Those who heard the accident did not hear any braking. There was no evidence of skid marks in the record, in the pictures that were submitted. This court in Davis relied on the absence of skid marks to conclude that there was no attempt, no evasive maneuver made before the accident occurred. All of these facts in the record contradict her statements and lead to the reasonable conclusion that her criminal negligence caused the accident. And of course, her level of intoxication. While courts have held that just the mere fact of being intoxicated by itself is not enough to prove criminal negligence. So the fact that someone has a .08 by itself is not enough. However, courts have also held that as that level of intoxication increases, the individual's culpability increases. And the inferences that can be drawn from other negligent behavior increase, because intoxication makes all negligence more dangerous, and because it slows down the amount of time it takes to take your eyes off the road. And being sleep deprived, I would submit common sense to infer that sleep deprivation results in the same effects on your reaction times. And so in light of those facts, the court came to a reasonable conclusion that her negligence, her intoxication, caused the accident, and that her negligence did constitute criminal negligence. And unless there are any further questions from the court, I would ask the court to affirm the conviction in this case, and I'll rest on my brief.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Very briefly, first of all, it was asserted by opposing counsel that Mr. Costello was incapable of darting quickly in front of the vehicle driven by Ms. Rich. But how do we know that? What evidence in the record tells us that? There was literally no evidence offered by the Commonwealth dealing with the braking qualities or the sound of braking associated with the car that was being driven, nor is there any evidence in the record showing the turning capabilities or the speed capabilities of this motorized device. And so in the absence of evidence, they're asking for you to speculate, just like they asked the trial judge to speculate. And that's just a bridge too far. They can't get there. In fact, it contradicts what the police said at appendix pages 175 and 176. And this is very critical. The accident reconstruction officer had to admit that he did not have any idea when the wheelchair entered her lane of travel. And in fact conceded that he could have turned in at the last second right in front of her without any warning at all in an unlit, unmarked, no reflectors device. Now, under such circumstances, if that's what happened, and there's an equal possibility that that's exactly what happened, if that's what happened, no one could have avoided this man. It's an unfortunate, terrible thing that he got hit. But no one could have avoided him under these circumstances. And an unresponsive man, not paying any attention, eating something, not lit, not marked, nothing, meandering around in the middle of the street, could have been doing circles, could have been going backwards, forwards, sideways. We don't know what he was doing. We don't know how fast he was doing it. It's all speculation. Now, she has been punished for DUI.
Can I ask you on that, though, because the pictures that are in the record where they put the wheelchair next to the vehicle shows, to try to match up the impact, shows the wheelchair headed across the street toward the sidewalk, it seems. So if the wheelchair, if he had turned and was hit coming at her head on, as you just mentioned might be a possibility, wouldn't that have been shown by the impact?
As I recall, what the evidence was, that he was facing southeast, and then it was determined that he was facing south. And so that would be across. So he darted in. So he was at one point, like he was going towards the oceanfront and also towards the trailer park. The next time that it was determined what he was doing, he was facing a different direction. Not entirely different direction, but at a different angle.
And she's going east, and he's then coming from your direction to the side.
Right, across.
Right.
So that means he went across her lane of travel, which is a problem. Because that indicates that he did it. I would ask that you please take a look at the cases that I summarized at pages 1 and 2 of the reply brief, because they, on causation, I think, strike the death blow to the Commonwealth's case. I see that I'm out of time, and I appreciate your indulgence today.
Thank you.
Thank you.